Welcome to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Health Integration Specialist Lena Berman, and I come to you weekly to discuss self-care and integrated health. Heart disease. It turns out that there are several reasons why somebody may have a heart attack. In the old days, it was assumed that the only reason that somebody would develop heart disease is from eating a high saturated fat diet and things like smoking and things like that we've known about. But in the last 10 years or so, research has uncovered a number of new reasons why an individual will have a heart attack, particularly individuals who are quite fit and healthy and not overweight and have a very moderate lifestyle and exercise, who have a very serious heart incident very young. You may remember when I interviewed Dr. Richard Coonan, an orthomolecular style doctor, we did an entire show about something called clotting factors, and we went over a number of different ones that affect the way that the blood clots or doesn't unclot after it clots. Blood always needs to clot, but sometimes it doesn't unclot, and then there's all kinds of other exotic ways that clotting can be affected. And one of them is something called small particle LDL. And a few weeks ago, I got a phone call from a man who's written a book called Eat Fat, Be Healthy, which I glanced at very quickly, found it to be rather conventional in its... I realized it was talking about clotting, one of the clotting factors, but it was it seemed very conventional in its recommendations. And so I rejected it. And the author, Matthew Bayan, called me. And he was so interesting and intelligent that I went ahead and reviewed the book and found it to be a very well-written book. Matthew Bayan is a journalist, so the book is extraordinarily well-written. And it seemed, after talking about clotting factors, like getting someone on who's had a very direct, rather violent experience of his own with an early heart attack that almost killed him, that having him as a guest on the show would be valuable to those of you who are struggling with why or if heart disease is something you should be careful of. So let me introduce my guest, Matthew Bayan. Let me make sure he's on the line. Are you with us?
Yes, I am. Good afternoon.
Hi. And give you your intro from your book here. Matthew Bayan has more than 25 years of experience managing nutrition and health programs in the public and private sectors. Since his massive coronary, he has been on the forefront of experimental treatment for the genetic defect he has named the heart stopper effect. He lives with his wife in Reno, Nevada. It's nice to hear that you married your fiancé, finally, who is, in a very moving way, figures into the whole story. The first thing I have to ask you is the title Eat Fat, Be Healthy your original title, or did they make you change it? What was your title for the book?
Actually, my first title was Heart Stopper.
Yeah, that which makes a lot more sense to me.
But they thought it sounded like a novel. So,
well, it is a novel.
In a way, it is, mm-hmm. because there's quite a thriller of a story in there.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't something that was crammed down my throat.
Oh, okay. Because I found the title confusing, and in fact, it isn't the case that you're telling people to go out and extravagantly eat fat. What you're saying is that for some people, well, actually, you know, I'll be honest with you. I don't want to get rancorous with you on the show because I really believe that you have something to offer that's valuable. But the researchers that I have on the show, the specialists who are biochemists and researchers in the field of lipid metabolism and stuff like that, don't agree that only certain people need to eat fat. Fat is a very important component of our diet, and this whole business of cholesterol has been debunked time and time again as a reason for having a heart incident. It might be valuable for you, in your own words, to explain what it is that's different about the particular genetic predisposition that you have. What is it that makes it different from there is no common heart incident, we've learned. There is nothing, no such thing as a... They're all uncommon.
I think the problem I think the problem in cardiology is that for decades there has been one paradigm, one concept, that heart disease was kind of a plain vanilla disease. It was caused by cholesterol, it was caused by lack of exercise, a buildup of plaque and deposits in one's arteries, and that brought on a heart attack. And it was believed that the thing to do is to go on a low-fat diet, stop smoking and exercise, and that should, at best, slow down or stop the effects of heart disease, but that you could not reverse it. That's the paradigm that has been in existence for about 30 years now. The recent technology has been able to look more and more deeply into what we consider to be cholesterol, the cholesterol molecules. And when you get down below the gross level of cholesterol, you begin to find hundreds and hundreds of different particles. And if you measure the types of particles that you have, you can determine very accurately what someone's heart attack risk is. Now, the genetics of this are very interesting. Roughly one out of four people carry particular genes. There are about three or four or five different ones. Any one of these genes can trigger an effect that will cause your body to basically change its fat management. It will begin to produce more of the worst bad cholesterol, which is called LDL cholesterol, and it will suppress the production of good cholesterol, your HDL cholesterol.
Can I just stop you for a moment? It always concerns me when people split cholesterol into good and bad, because honestly, you couldn't live without LDL cholesterol in your bloodstream.
No, that's true.
Okay, so why don't you explain why you like HDL better than LDL?
Well, you're right. Cholesterol is a basic component for many different hormones, estrogen, testosterone. It's converted into vitamin D. You need cholesterol.
It also carries antioxidants throughout the body, and it's the LDL that does that, actually.
Right. There are a number of, you know, obviously you can't strip away the cholesterol, and that's one of the myths that's been out there, that you eat a low-fat diet, you don't eat cholesterol, and this is somehow going to be magic. HDL is considered good cholesterol because it is the scrubber that moves through the bloodstream, and it breaks down the deposits of LDL cholesterol that form inside your arteries. So in a normal person, these are in balance. You have LDL cholesterol, which performs certain functions and which sometimes begins to build up on artery walls and cause blockage. And then you have HDL that comes along and scrubs away that blockage. If those are in balance, you don't have a problem. And in most people, it is in balance. The problem with heart stopper genes is that it upsets that balance, and it begins to create a type of cholesterol called small particle LDL. This is the worst kind of LDL in the sense that it is the most likely to stick to artery walls. It sticks to the arteries about 40% faster than normal LDL. And if you have a larger percentage of this type of LDL, you are at great risk for a heart attack because it builds up very quickly. It forms a very unstable kind of blockage that can tear, it can break, piece can fall off. And that causes a blood clot to form, and it's the blood clot that will kill you.
Yeah. You know, I, again, going back, I just have to compliment you on this book because I choose to read a lot of scientific literature, and it's a rare treat to read a book that's written by a writer and a journalist. It's very rare. There are people who hire medical writers to write their books, but they have a very... their style of writing is formulaic, and yours is written very much like a novel. In fact, it would be fascinating to do a film of this, in fact, because it moves in and out of time in an interesting way. And your writing is really quite good. I was really very moved by, because in fact, part of what this book is about is what it's like to die 72 times in an emergency room. And come back and go then and then, and the choices and the things that went on. It's really astonishing. Of course, it is a little bit a book that also cautions patients not to be passive in a hospital situation. But we can go back to that.
Thank you for the compliment.
Oh, it's a wonderful, wonderful book. All right, so what we're saying here is that you have one of these clotting factors, and there are some warning signs with these clotting factors. There is a tie-in with triglycerides, and normally when we think of triglycerides, which are also blood fats along with cholesterol, but they're blood fats that seem to be formed when there's a inefficiency in the way that the body recognizes the signal from insulin and blood sugars and fats are sort of sent back into the bloodstream. Also, a diet very high in carbohydrates and starches will cause this. We usually think of high triglycerides as a pre-diabetic situation, but in fact, it occurs with people with your gene.
Yes, in fact, I don't have any predisposition at all to diabetes. My glucose level is relatively low normally, and yet I have high triglycerides if my body's left alone, if it's not treated in any way. And that's one of the signals, although not the only signal. There's a great danger in using the what is called the lipid panel. Most people who go to their doctor and get some kind of cholesterol checkup, they get a test called a lipid panel, which shows your total cholesterol, your HDL, your LDL, and your triglycerides. It's been shown in a couple of research pieces that these tests are inaccurate in determining whether somebody has the heart stopper effect. In fact, they're inaccurate from 20 to 50% is the error rate, which is far too good or too great to base a medical decision on, particularly when you're dealing with a life-threatening illness.
Mm-hmm.
Triglycerides, in many cases, I'm not going to say in all cases, but in many cases, will give you an indication that you might have a heart stopper gene. There are some combinations. Your HDL will tend to be low. It'll be under 45. Your LDL will tend to be higher. It'll be over 160. And your triglycerides will tend to be high. They'll be up in the 140, 160 range or higher.
Which, incidentally, is not a red flag for most doctors.
No. In fact, if you look at your laboratory tests, they will frequently flag something that they consider to be high. Most labs don't consider those levels high. So as an indicator that you could have a more serious problem, the normal lipid panel is virtually worthless. The error is just too great. I wouldn't bet my life on it. Many doctors, and this is one of the unfortunate situations, we're still ahead of the curve here. The information has not yet caught up to the medical community. There is research out there, huge amounts of research, mm-hmm. in fact, that back all of this up. But doctors are still working on the old paradigm, and they believe that the gold standard for cardiac analysis is the lipid panel, when in fact it's not. If you consider your odds are 1 out of 4 of having a heart stopper gene, and your chances are maybe up to 50% that the lipid panel will miss it, that's pretty high chance that you're going to slip through. I slipped through. I had a thorough cardiac workup. I mean thorough. Stress test, echocardiogram, 5 weeks before my heart attack. And they missed everything.
And you also had no symptoms. Well, you had, I shouldn't say none. You had a couple of incidents where you had something that might have been, if you'd known, you know, hindsight, that might have been suspicious. But in fact, you were, you know, vigorous and you were exercising and... So it kind of came out of the blue. It wasn't the case that you had angina or chest pains or weakness. You just were asleep one night and woke up with a heart attack.
I had a little signal 5 weeks before. I had some kind of it wasn't pain. It was sort of like a twitching feeling in my chest. It was strange, and it was something I'd never experienced before, so I went to the hospital. And they held me overnight, and they tested me. And that's when I had the stress test and a thorough blood analysis. And I swear, I'm not making a joke, my doctor said my Lanta. They thought I had acid reflux.
Oh, God.
And so here I was chugging my Lanta for 5 weeks, and then I had a heart attack.
Right.
Today, looking at that same lab work, my doctor, my current cardiologist, who's an expert in this area, looked at it and said, my God, you had unstable angina, and usually within 6 weeks, unstable angina resolves itself in a heart attack. Well, I was right on time. 5 weeks later, bam, I got hit.
Why don't you explain what you mean by unstable angina? Because, you know, we usually associate this with chest pain on exertion.
Right. The standard, what most people feel when they have chest pain, is some kind of a pressure or a referred pain. You may actually, your teeth may hurt. You may have pain down your arm.
Left arm.
It can be either arm.
Really?
Actually. Yes.
Okay, but not. It would be. You know, it wouldn't be bilateral. It would be on one side.
It's usually the left arm, but it could be both.
Uh-huh.
It can feel like someone is sticking a screwdriver in the back of your spine.
How nice.
Very nice. you could just be dizzy. You might have fainting spells. There are a lot of symptoms.
But they come out of the blue is the point. It's like it isn't ongoing. You just all of a sudden you have this sort of weird stuff.
And it will usually happen after some kind of exertion. Mm-hmm. Because your heart's not getting enough oxygen and you're exerting it and it's sort of falling behind the curve. Stable angina or angina, depending on how you want to say it.
We use both pronunciations.
Okay. I'm glad to know I'm not 50% wrong. Stable angina is something that is normally treated with nitroglycerin, which expands your arteries and creates more blood flow. It tends to be chronic, and it tends to last over a long period of time, slowly getting worse to the point where then somebody gets bypass surgery or angioplasty. Unstable angina is not necessarily pain. It can be discomfort. It could be dizziness. The difference is in the way the actual mechanism is working. And to do this, let's just think of an artery as a pipe. You know, inside this pipe, you have, for most people who develop heart disease, you'll have a slow buildup of cholesterol, which will slowly squeeze down the circumference of that pipe so that it becomes more and more restrictive. When it reaches the point where it restricts the blood enough, you will begin to have heart pain. And if it becomes more severe, you'll have a heart attack. Now, unstable angina is caused by a different kind of plaque. For most people, that plaque grows slowly. It's very tough. It's what's called stable plaque. If you have unstable plaque, which is frequently what the heart stopper gene causes because it makes it build up very quickly, this unstable plaque is just what it says, unstable. It can break off, a crack can form in it, and that's the danger for creating a blood clot and causing a very sudden heart attack. Unstable angina is a product of that unstable plaque. It comes and goes. Mm. You know, you can have a blood clot start to form, and in fact, they believe that's what happened to me, that a blood clot formed, maybe occluded half the artery, I began to feel something, and then it dissolved. And I was fine for 5 more weeks. And then finally it came back and was even worse.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the hallmark of unstable angina.
Since we're talking very specifically, well, let me just ID the show. This is Your Own Health and Fitness, and I'm health integrationist Lena Berman on the phone with Matthew Bayon, who's written it's a wonderful read, I must say, and a rather interesting book about one of the unusual sorts of clotting factors which are causing early heart attacks or later heart attacks in people who may even not have any obvious reason to. I mean, Matthew was on a very low-fat diet, things like that, exercised. So one of these things where, you know, you hear about somebody is a runner or something and they suddenly drop dead. What is that? Well, this is one of the things that it can be. The book is called Eat Fat, Be Healthy. And only in very small letters down below it says small particle LDL syndrome, which he's talking about. But he's talking about something he calls the heart stopper gene, which is in the dip. What is that called? Subtitle of the book. This book is published by Scribner. And Bayon is B-A-Y-A-N, Bayon. Since we're getting specific about this small particle LDL, as opposed to all the other clotting factors that are out there that are also causing these kinds of problems that function slightly differently, you talk about the fact that there's a type A and type B LDL, and then there's crossovers. So there's this kind of, when we talk about intervention or prevention, we're looking at recruitable LDL, if such a thing were possible to say, right? We're talking about switching some of it over, that there's a type of LDL that's going to be more unstable. The small particle stuff is going to be more unstable than the intermediate or large, and that there's some capacity given, you know, what you do to change that. Is that right?
Here's the good news. There is a very large capacity to make this change. This is a very treatable disease. The tragedy is that people don't know they have it. I know I have it now. I mean, I was dramatically woken up to that fact.
You really upset your dog, too. You're a bad person for doing that. You really scared your dog.
My poor dog.
Yeah. To say nothing of your fiancé.
My poor everybody. They all almost had their own heart attacks after this happened. The good news is that you can treat this, and it's not that difficult to treat. I'm a good example of that. We recently did a an angiogram, which is really the most accurate way of determining what your coronary status is, you actually, the way that works is the doctor actually snakes a sensor up into your arteries, up around your heart, and they pump dye in, and through an x-ray they can look at it and they can see where the dye goes and where it doesn't go, and they can determine if there are any blockages. It's very accurate. And we found, here I am 4 years later, that I don't have any blockage at all now.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to have blockage.
Right. You know, there is a very interesting doctor, cardiologist, who calls himself a non-invasive cardiologist. His name is Dr. Wayne, Howard Wayne, and he's written several books. One of them is called How to Protect Yourself from Your Doctor. And he doesn't like angiograms. He really doesn't like them because he says that they are irritating to the arteries and can cause things to happen just by ramming these things up and around in there. But there is a blood test that you discuss in the book called the gradient gel electrophoresis.
Yes. Actually, you're right about angiograms. There is a 1 in 1,000 chance of having a stroke while it's underway, so it's not something you do lightly.
Well, and they say 1 in 1,000, but they use those kinds of terms all the time. You had lots of 1 in 1,000 things happen to you in the hospital, and they all happened to you. You were the one.
Yeah, that's why I feel safe having an angiogram now. Cause,
right. Nothing else can happen to you.
Nothing else. I'm bulletproof.
Yes,
the testing, what you were asking me about the testing that can be done for the blood test. There are actually two tests I found out. Now, there's an MRI technique, which I haven't researched thoroughly, but I'm told it's quite accurate as well. But the simplest test is just a blood draw, and you ship it off to a lab. And actually, you're right in the area where this is done.
Yeah, it's in Berkeley.
Berkeley Heart Lab is the place where these tests are done. In fact, where many of these techniques have been developed. And there's a doctor there whose name is Robert Sapirko, who's part of the University of California system, who's been doing this research. He himself has this disease.
Yeah.
And the weird thing was they were looking at, they were trying to calibrate a machine one day and they needed a blood sample, so he just drew some of his real quickly, and he found out he had the very disease he was researching.
Oh.
So he's a very motivated researcher. That's why I like him.
How do you spell his last name?
Superko, Superko.
Okay. At the California, the Berkeley Heart Lab.
He's at the University of California, Berkeley, at the Lipid Institute, and he also has a private lab called the Berkeley Heart Lab that does the testing. But this test is very simple, and it's very accurate, and it shows you the breakout of those LDL particles. You know, how many small particles, how many large particles. And you can shift the body's production away from small particles to larger particles.
These are all LDL, but they're less dangerous.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
They're still LDL, but they're the less dangerous kind. And you can do it through diet, and you can do it through... you don't even have to call it medication. Really, it's vitamin supplements.
If you catch it early enough, and that was the place I was going to kind of go toward the end of the show, is that... We'll go there toward the end about how to treat this. Now, one of the things that we're talking about, which is why you named the book, you know, Eat Fat, is this whole business of cholesterol being demonized and the fact that somebody on a very low-fat diet... Now, this is something you mentioned. You go right ahead and you discuss Ornish and you show some studies with Ornish. The thing that I keep running into with Ornish's diet is that people initially go on a whole foods diet, which is better than what they've been doing. They stop eating sugar and they lose some weight, which takes a lot of pressure off the heart. And eventually, after a while, 6 months or so, their whole cholesterol number goes down, which looks fine. But then, sure enough, the LDL goes up and the HDL goes down, the LDL goes up, and their triglycerides get high. This is something that happens to most people that I'm aware of on this diet. So, you know, that's why I say I don't think it's just small particle LDL people who should not eat an extreme low-fat diet, and particularly not a low-protein diet, because you need so many things in the protein to repair what's going on in your body.
Well, you're right. And, in fact, there was some scary research done at the University of California at Berkeley. They actually did this research twice, and they took a group of men that they had screened for small particle LDL, and they knew that they did not have it. These were normal men. And they put them on a low-fat diet. The first group they put on a 24% of calories diet, which is not real low, but it's low. It's not drastic. Within 6 weeks, 41% of those men converted to the high production of small particle LDL.
Right.
The research.
Normal people.
These were normal people. They don't have my gene.
Right.
And researchers were shocked at this. They repeated the test, and this time they put them on the Ornish diet, which was 10%. of calories as fat. And this was even crazier. In 10 days, 32% of those men shifted over to high small particle production in 10 days, which means their heart attack risk tripled in a week and a half. Now, that's pretty significant, and that's normal people. Now, you throw it to somebody like me. I was put on the Ornish diet by one of the certified Ornish centers in Des Moines, Iowa, when I was there, and my blood chemistry went haywire.
Yes.
Now, I'm not down on Ornish. I think Ornish...
He's trying.
He's trying, and I think he's had success with certain people. But if you don't screen for people who have this propensity first, you could kill them.
Well, not just that, but if you don't screen for people... But look, I mean, we know that triglycerides are going to go up if you eat primarily carbohydrates. And it isn't, you know, if you eat tree bark, you're likely to just eliminate it and not have it pass through your system. But all grains, and then if you start making grain into flour, it becomes sweet. It becomes more and more available as a high, you know, it's more and more sugar. Is more and more. I mean, anyone who's eaten a refined cracker, you know, a white cracker or something, knows the minute it hits your saliva, it turns to sugar. So anybody who eats a high carbohydrate diet is likely to be at risk of raising your triglyceride levels and lowering your good HDL. There is an inordinate amount of research shows that it actually a protein-rich diet with the right amount of balance, the balance of fats is what matters. It isn't even... You talk a little bit about watching out for saturated fat, and we'll talk about that at the end. Why? Because as I said, I've had these fat researchers and people on. But really, clearly, balance is the issue. It's about balance and also knowing your history. Now, before we go to break, I just want to mention that one of the ways that people can begin to have a sense of whether this is happening is when somebody comes into my office. I have an educational consulting practice in health, and they start describing a family history where there are strokes and heart attacks, not in very elderly people, but in younger people, and it's all over the place, and atherosclerosis and all this kind of stuff, and they're not feeling well, I immediately think of clotting factors.
Oh, yes.
So that's important.
It's amazing to me how much of that is ignored by doctors. I'm a perfect case. My father died at the age of 50 of a heart attack. My grandfather died at 57 of a heart attack. His two brothers died in the early 50s of heart attacks. They had two sons who died at 35 and 43.
Mm.
Out of eight family members in the past three generations, I'm the only one to survive.
Yeah.
Now, you know, looking at that, somebody should say, there's something going on here.
Thank God we now know what it can be. I mean, we're starting to have the research to support this clotting stuff. So, we're going to break shortly. I've got a couple more seconds here, and I'm trying to think whether I can use it. A couple things. Women in the Heart Stopper, you mentioned, well, first of all, you talk about the fact that smoking, you know, if you're really tired of living, that's when you start smoking.
That's right.
Because it doesn't, there's nothing it does more than hurt the heart. I mean, the lungs, yeah, but it really kills the heart, and forever it really does a lot of damage. And then women, after menopause, if they have the heart stopper gene, are going to be more susceptible and may be good candidates for estrogen therapy when it's balanced, I have
right.
to say, with natural progesterone, which has been demonized because people don't know the difference between synthetic and natural progesterone. Estrogen never taken alone, always with natural progesterone.
The problem, too, I mean, women need to face the fact that they're more likely to die of a heart attack than all forms of cancer combined.
Well, yes, although I see women in my practice who have taken unopposed estrogen, and it's nasty when they do that, especially if it's a synthetic, you know, sort of pharmaceutical version of it. You can get compounded hormones that match the molecular structure in your body, and you must use progesterone with estrogen. There's this whole balancing act. You talk about the balancing act of the different cholesterols. Everything in the body is balancing and needs opposition, proper opposition. Or be contested. All right, so we're going to break. I'm Lena Berman, Your Own Health and Fitness, talking with Matthew Bayan, B-A-Y-A-N, author of Eat Fat, Be Healthy, about small particle LDL.
And my heart is on that ship out in mid-ocean. They say that death is a tragedy. It comes one.
Welcome back. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. Lena Berman, and I'm on the phone with Matthew Bayan, B-A-Y-A-N, author of Eat Fat, Be Healthy, talking about small particle LDL. This is a clotting factor that causes, it's a genetic predisposition that can cause heart attacks in people who appear to be just fine. And it's published by Scribner Press. It should be available through the usual means. Is there anything that you want to give out at this point? This is a good halfway point. If you have, do you have a website, don't you?
Yes, I do. The easiest way to remember it is the title of the book. It's eatfatbehealthy.com.
That is easy.
And from that, I've got links to various heart resources, the American Heart Association, the labs that do the testing that discover these genes, and, you know, various information. I think that people, there are certain questions people ask right up front, and I've put them right on the website, and then from there they can go where they want or, you know, go buy the book or whatever they need to do.
All right, so it's eatfatbehealthyoneword.com,
right.
With the W's in the front. And then if people miss part of today's show and want to get a cassette copy, I don't have transcripts, they can call my information number 24 hours a day at 707-773-4727. You mention problems with cholesterol-lowering drugs. Why don't you explain what the problem is, aside from the obvious sort of, you know, well, one thing, let me say one thing also, because we were talking about Ornish. What people don't understand is, what I said earlier is cholesterol serves a purpose in the body, even the LDL, all of it is there for a reason. And when the body starts doing weird stuff, it's because it's compensating for some imbalance, but it's there for a reason. If you get rid of cholesterol, if you really lower, if you bottom out your cholesterol levels so that your cholesterol is way below normal, the research shows that you're more at risk for strokes and you're more at risk for cancer. So, you know, we love excess in this culture, so we do this all or nothing thing. So one of the reasons that cholesterol-lowering drugs are funny is because, from my point of view, is because the cholesterol is there for a reason and you need to find out why it's happening. And take care of why it's happening instead of putting a Band-Aid over the warning light by using. And if you lower your cholesterol too low, you're going to lose, you're going to bottom out your sex hormones and you're going to be more at risk for some other diseases. So you can't just sort of squish things around. But you had a specific problem with them in terms of altering the characteristic of the cholesterol.
Well, one of the concerns that I have is that doctors rather indiscriminately hand these drugs out. And the problem is, if you're diagnosed with heart disease, they're very likely to put you on a cholesterol-lowering drug. If you do that, you begin to think that you're okay. You look at that lipid panel, and my God, your cholesterol was at 260, and now it's down to 180. Oh boy, you're healthy. Your LDL has dropped, your triglycerides have dropped. You think you're now in the normal range. The problem is, these drugs have absolutely no effect on the heart stopper genes. You will continue to produce the small particle LDL in your body. It will continue to form blockage in your arteries. Yet you think you're fine. You know, you're walking around lulled into a false sense of security. And your doctor will say, you're fine. Your cholesterol levels are average now. The key here is you have to get the LDL testing, or the, I call it subclass testing, the subclass tests that look at the kinds of LDL that you're producing. Without that test, your lipid panel and your cholesterol-lowering drugs are going to give you a false reading. And remember, your odds are 1 out of 4. So you can have a perfectly normal-looking cholesterol panel and be taking these drugs, and it's masking the symptoms that are more serious, that are more dangerous.
Now, when we talk about sort of prevention of this, if there's a family history and whatnot, prudent sort of interventions to take care of yourself before you have any kind of symptoms are to look at the ratio of fats in your diet to carbohydrates and proteins and various things like that, right? Isn't that what you're advocating?
That's part of it. Yeah, I think that I believe in a balanced diet. I've increased my fat intake from what I was on, the diet that I was on right after my heart attack. And I feel a lot better and my blood values are a lot more stable. I think the American Heart Association is probably pretty accurate when they talk about roughly 30%. I think you can go to 40% of your calories
mm-hmm.
as being fat.
I think so, too.
If it's mainly monounsaturated fat.
Mm-hmm.
I think this past year, 99, was amazing. The American Heart Association, for the first time, did not just recommend a low-fat diet. They also came out and said for some people, the substitution of monounsaturated fats for saturated fats could be an alternative. And they didn't talk about going down to 30%. 40% seems fine. I think that's a watershed event in the American Heart Association to have made such a change.
Yeah, they're usually very slow. And actually, to be honest with you, they're still being slow because there are people who have been saying this for a long time. There's a lot of old research that supports this. I don't know if you know about this, but there's research also that discusses the dangers of eating too many polyunsaturated vegetable oils, because polyunsaturated vegetable oils oxidate easily, and you do mention that in your book.
I tend toward monounsaturates.
Yes.
I throw out polyunsaturates in my book as kind of a middle ground. If people, you know, people may resist going the whole way. I figure, okay, at least if you eat polyunsaturates versus saturated fats, that's better.
It's better if you maintain a healthy balance between the polyunsaturated fats. So this is one thing you didn't mention in the book, and I don't know if you're aware of this, but there is a lot of research. There was an enormous research project that I've mentioned before on the air that was done in Japan to try to determine why they were getting more heart disease and cancer, and they thought it was the protein and the animal fats, the saturated fats. What they discovered was when they started eating more animal protein, the incidence of stroke went down in the country. But that wasn't the problem. The problem is they stopped eating fish, and they started using polyunsaturated vegetable oils like corn oil and peanut oil, which are very high in... There are two classes of essential fats that we don't make in our body, sixes and threes. And the vegetable oils have a lot of sixes in them, which are very vulnerable. All of them, all polyunsaturates are vulnerable to oxidation, so they have to be handled very carefully and shouldn't be heated and things like that. But in addition, they stopped eating fish and started frying everything in these omega-6 oils. So the ratio of the omega-3s from the fish and from things like the flax or other sources, but got skewed toward the sixes. And the sixes got very high, plus they were damaged fats. And that's when they got into trouble. So one of the additions I might make to your book is the inclusion of omega-3 fatty acids in the diet, because it has a tremendous effect on thinning the blood and protecting people from heart disease. It's really quite extraordinary. The literature is amazing.
That's why I mentioned eating fish. And in my food charts, I focus on that.
When you're dealing with somebody who has really got a propensity, I don't know if I do or not, but even people who just suspect or just want to be optimal in their health, you'd have to eat fish from here until next week. You couldn't eat enough fish to get enough of those fats to really make a substantial difference. And then in addition, when you do that, you, of course, have to add in more vitamin E, which you do. You recommend 800, but with these clotting factors, sometimes 1,200, unless somebody is taking a blood thinner already. So the other thing I wanted to ask you, Matthew, is did you know, I think you know this because you've written about nutrition, that not all fats, even animal fats, not all fats are one thing. They're always a combination of things. And, for instance, even beef, which is 50% saturated fat, is 50% other fats, including some of the ones that are healthful, like conjugated linoleic acid and things like that. But the other thing is that pork, which people always demonize, is actually very high in monounsaturated fat. It's about 60%.
You know, we have so many food myths, and, you know, we demonize some things and we elevate other things, and then a fad comes along and it starts to change. I agree with you. I mean, I think it all has to do with the consumer, the patient, has got to begin to get a little bit more educated, has to read and take responsibility for our own health,
our
own bodies.
And you certainly did that, and I think it's something we should talk about. You had some experiences while you were in the hospital, even when you woke up paralyzed. No one said anything to you. You're laying there. You can hardly breathe through the tube.
Step back a little bit and tell a little bit of the story.
I think so.
This whole thing started. I was 45 years old. 4 a.m. in the morning, I wake up having a nightmare because something was horrible happening to me. And I had this horrible pain in my chest. I felt like I was being crushed by a truck. And I tried to get out of bed, and I could barely move. And I thought, my first thought was indigestion. And after about 2 minutes, I realized this could not possibly be indigestion. And I began to think, well, maybe it's my heart. And then I thought, no, it can't be that, because I've just had a big heart checkup, and I was told I was fine. And I probably lost 2 minutes there believing that I was fine. Then I realized it was just too serious, and I crawled, literally, I crawled to the phone to call an ambulance. And they took me in, I made it to the hospital just before my heart stopped. If I had stopped in the ambulance, my chances of survival would have been about 10%. I probably wouldn't have made it. But I got there 5 minutes before my heart stopped, and then they began working on me. And over the next 3 hours, my heart stopped 72 times, and they brought me back each time.
They were going to quit, too, because that was ridiculous already.
I actually heard one of the doctors say at some point, he's dead. And I remember I was conscious, but I couldn't move and I couldn't sense anything around me. And I remember thinking, oh, my God, they're going to give up. They're going to walk away. Please don't walk away. And it seemed like eternity went by, and I got hit by another electric shock. And the other cardiologist wasn't giving up. And this guy I talked to afterwards, he's a demon. He wouldn't give up. He said, you kept coming back, and I was going to keep doing it all night if I had to. So, at any rate, when I finally woke up the final time, after about 3 hours of them working on me, I couldn't move. And if you've ever had claustrophobia, I've never had it, but this was sudden claustrophobia. I was trapped in my body. And I thought, I was still muddy-brained, I didn't know what was going on, and I thought, my God, did I have a stroke? Is that what happened? Because I couldn't move. And I thought, am I trapped like this as a vegetable for the rest of my life? And all I could do was open my eyes and move my eyes. That's all I could do. And I was looking around, and I could see the clock on the wall, and I could see people, you know, in white clothes, nurses and doctors, moving around me outside my field of vision, and I could hear them talking. Nobody came near my face. I laid there for almost 3 hours before anybody noticed that I was awake. And in that 3 hours, that was like hell. It was being trapped in a prison that you couldn't get out of. Finally, somebody came and loomed over me, and it was a nurse, and she said, I think he's awake. And I'm thinking, yeah, finally. And anyway, I was paralyzed because they had given me a drug to paralyze me because I was thrashing around, and while they were doing an angioplasty, they can't have you thrashing around. But I didn't know that at the time. And afterwards, I spoke to the doctor, and I said, Doctor, I was trying to signal to your nurses. They would ask me questions, and I was blinking once for yes and twice for no, which is kind of universal. I said, nobody seemed to recognize that. You might want to tell them that that's something you should check. Check to see if a patient's awake and then see if you can communicate with them. And I know he blistered them afterwards because he took them out in the hall.
Yeah, but there's so many other levels to this, like the fact that even if somebody is out, we don't know how out is. I mean, you were hearing things when technically you were dead.
Yeah.
So people hear, you know, so what would it be so terrible to sort of check the person periodically and say to them a few times, you've been given a drug to paralyze you because we were doing a sensitive, so don't be frightened. I mean, how difficult is this? My God.
That would have been very helpful.
Oh, God. I know. The other thing that's very, very moving in your book is the description of what it was like to keep sort of going back to this kind of limbo waiting place that was very gentle and lovely, and you felt very good about it, and you didn't really necessarily want to leave, but you were drawn back by the fact that your fiancé wasn't there.
Yeah, I haven't talked about this much. In fact, I haven't talked about it in any interviews yet. I only put a little snippet of it in the book.
It's very moving.
We had written a chapter about it, and my editor decided he wanted to take it out because it was sort of another direction, and he didn't want to move the book too far off its base. And I agreed. It was a very strange experience. I was quite disconnected from here. I was someplace else, and I was there for a very long time. Now, when I know that I was out for 3 hours, yet where I was, far longer than 3 hours went by. I mean, months went by. I was in some other place. And it's difficult to explain. I try to, you know, sort of touch on it in the book a little bit. But it was as if I had gone away and the whole universe had opened up for me. I could go wherever I wanted to go. And it felt as if this is the next step. You know, once I'm dead, this is what I do. And I had a choice at some point. I didn't go through any of this tunnel of light stuff. I didn't, you know, none of the classic things that you read about. I didn't experience any of that. There were no angels leading me along or, you know, nothing of that sort. But I knew I was in another reality because it was quite real. Color was real. Texture was real. Smell, everything. I was able to sense things as vividly, if not more so, than when I'm awake. And at some point, I realized that I had the ability also to go back. Now, I don't know whether I was brought back physically by the doctor and I had no choice, or whether I really did have the choice. It felt like I did. It felt like there was a place to sort of move through, and if I moved through it, I would come back to my old life. And I made that choice. I remember thinking, well, I want to see my wife, my fiance at the time. I'd like to see her. I'd like to spend the rest of my life with her, because I know after I die, I'm coming right back here. So I might as well enjoy this intervening time. And I made the decision to come back. And I felt it was a conscious decision. I felt very much that I had to move to a certain place, and once I did that, I would come back, and that's when I woke up. So it's something that I thought about a lot. I can't quite totally understand what happened to me.
Well, and one of the things that you express very clearly in the book is how much coming back was like being born. And especially because they were putting 300 joules on you, which burned your flesh. You know, I mean, it was, you say in there, you know, that you made this decision to come back, and you say, you idiot, you know, and then it's this birth experience, and it's very violent. So you endured really terrible physical pain and fear and trauma and all that kind of stuff in the hospital and all that. And you really fought for a long time to, because you were a real scrapper in the hospital. I mean, if you hadn't been, you might not have survived, because there was a point where you had congestive heart failure stuff happening, and they were doing stupid stuff, and you figured out that the oxygen mask was causing fluid to collect in your lungs, and you weaned yourself off. I mean, how important it is for people to trust their intuition about what's going on. And you basically saved your life by removing the oxygen mask, weaning yourself off of it, because it was causing fluid to collect in your lungs, because you figured it out, you thought it through. But the thing that was I guess the question I have, it is just, and I don't mean to sound like Baba Wawa, but how do you feel about the decision that you made? Are you glad you came back?
Very much.
Yeah.
I think my life's a lot calmer now, because I have I tell people who have asked about this, you know, I've been through the dress rehearsal. I know what it's like. I know where it's going. And I don't fear death the way I did before. I've been there. I think that's made me feel a lot more calm about my life. And it's also made me want to do things that I think are important. Writing this book was something that I felt was, you know, after months and months of discussing it with my wife, I finally said, yeah, this is an important thing to do, and I can save people's lives, and this is something that I want to do, and I'll put my energy into it. And I'm spending more time writing and doing things that are fulfilling to me, rather than worrying about nine to five job or what's happening with the car or anything of that nature. I think it's changed my perspective. And yes, I am very much glad to be back, and also glad to be very healthy. Mm. I'm as healthy as I've ever been, if not more so, which is
wonderful.
Amazing.
That's wonderful. Well, let's talk a little bit about when we talked initially on the phone. I said, well, you know, you're using these drugs, and and you said, well, no, I do, you know, if I hadn't lost such a huge part of my heart, I might not try any drugs at all. Let's talk about some of the vitamins that work. And one thing I wanted to ask you about is, you know, you're taking niacin, which the research for niacin in this sort of application goes back to the 40s, and it's been ignored. I mean, Abram Hoffer, who I had on my show, who's the pioneer of vitamin therapy, sort of gave Linus Pauling his push, who's still practicing as a doctor at 87 or something. One of the things he talks about with niacin is that it's dose-dependent. You can't give one person 300 milligrams, and that's going to work. Some people need 4,000 milligrams, some need 1,000, and that's something you discovered. But one concern I have is that you're taking a prescription version of niacin. Do you know that, you know, if you take the natural vitamin that you may get a better effect?
Well, it's been...
You're also paying through the nose for it, you know?
It's not that much. I'm paying about $8 a bottle, and it lasts me a month.
Oh, okay.
I looked at different forms of niacin, and I discuss it with my cardiologist, and at the moment, it's kind of like, I started with this one, I'm comfortable with it, we know what the results are, I'm not having any problems, so I'm going to stick with it.
Okay.
I agree with you, and I'm thinking more in terms now, as I feel better, to maybe look at some alternatives.
Mm-hmm.
But initially, it was kind of like, we've got to do something right now.
Mm-hmm.
We've got to take control, and we've got to turn your system around, and that's what we accomplished.
Good news. Well, just for the rest of the folks there, niacin is a vitamin. It does cause flushing. There is a no-flush version of it. For heart patients with small particle LDL, you have to take niacin. You can't use niacinamide. And what Abram Hoffer suggests for the flushing is chasing it with cold water during a meal. I mean, not your face, but drinking some cold water. Splash yourself with the cold. Some people find 250 milligrams of inositol 5 minutes before the dose will cause the flushing not to happen. Antihistamines will control the flushing because the flushing is a histamine reaction. Now, antihistamines are not great things on their own, but there is a homeopathic, this is my own advice, there is a homeopathic remedy of histamine, which you can take like a 30C under your tongue and use as a, helps with as an antihistamine-like effect. 1 to 2 aspirins a few days before starting niacin therapy will also help with flushing. And then, Matthew, do you know about how important vitamin C is for heart disease and this type of condition?
Yes, I do.
Oh, good. So you're mainlining that.
Yes, I take vitamin C and I take E. I take a B complex. Mm-hmm. I also take a larger than normal dose of folic acid.
Yes.
We've sort of developed a shotgun technique, my cardiologist and I. Anything that might be a risk factor, we shoot something at. It's kind of like homocysteine is not high. I don't have a high level. It's not normal, but it's a risk factor. There's mm-hmm. no lower threshold below which it becomes not a risk. So I take folic acid. The same with vitamin C and E. There are some conflicting results in terms of what the benefits are, but
not really. Not if you really look critically at the research.
Well, it flashes back and forth, and things pop out in the news. And I have people say to me, "Well, why are you doing that? Because haven't you read such and such?"
Yeah, but what you see in the news is they gave very small doses of synthetic versions of these vitamins to people who had heart disease. You can't use small doses. You have to use mega doses for people with heart disease.
I agree with you. Yeah. And that's why I just stick to my guns.
You're right.
But, you know, a combination of these things, and again, something you said earlier that I think is very important, no one dose of any specific drug or vitamin or no one specific food, oil, fat, you name it, is going to be right for everybody. Everybody's got a different system. What works for me may not work exactly the same for you.
That's right.
And what you have to do, it's part art and part science. You have to kind of feel around and find the sweet spot for your particular body in terms of what it is you're going to eat and what it is you're going to take as a supplement or as a drug. And I think the challenge is finding a doctor who's willing to do that with you.
Yes.
Who's willing to do the blood tests, and maybe you make a diet change and you do another blood test to see what the effect is. It's kind of like scientific research on your own body.
That's what it is.
And you fine-tune the results, and you work on it and get to a point that it's satisfactory and you're happy with it and the doctor's happy with it. And that takes months. In fact, in my case, it took over a year to come to a point where it was, you know, we were pretty comfortable with what we were doing. I find a lot of doctors don't want to do that. They don't want to take the time to do that.
Well, and things change, and you're exercising too. But let me before the show we run out of time, let me go ahead and give people some of the research on, just to give them some of the other things that affect, that are good for the heart in these kinds of situations. There was research to support using up to 3,000 milligrams a day of taurine, which is a amino acid. It helps with the systolic left ventricle function, which I think is affected in your situation. Is it not, Matthew? Or is that different? Okay. There's also a CoQ10, which is also works synergistically with carnitine, another sort of amino acid, which is very good for preventing and strengthening the heart muscle and preventing congestive heart problems. Garlic is reputed to be good for the heart. Some people don't do well with garlic, and the omega-3 fats, as I've mentioned. Balancing minerals is absolutely essential because calcium is a vasoconstrictor and magnesium a dilator, and particularly magnesium with mitral valve prolapse, and along with potassium, which controls fluid balance. So making sure there is enough magnesium and a balance of magnesium and calcium to the degree that people can tolerate it in their bowel, because magnesium is a cathartic, and then the potassium to help with the balance of the sodium.
You know, there's another factor there with potassium that I have found, at least personally. For some reason, my potassium level is normally low. It's at the very lowest end of what's considered normal. And when I'm that low, I experience what are called PVCs. They're kind of, they're called premature ventricular contractions. My heart kind of does a double beat, and it's very uncomfortable, and it can be dangerous if a lot of them happen. When I raised my potassium level, I take a supplement for that went away.
Yeah.
That was one of the scariest things that I was experiencing.
Potassium's wonderful. And the last thing is that the herb hawthorn is very good for the heart and protects the heart against congestive heart failure, which is where the heart is getting so weak that the lungs are filling with fluid. So that's a brief swap, whatever the word is. You're the writer.
Swipe.
Thank you. At some of the vitamins. We're just about out of time. I was very moved by this book, which was a problem because I then stayed up very late reading it because I actually read it instead of just scanning it really quickly. You know, I know this stuff. Blah, blah, blah. I was actually reading it. But I do recommend the book to people partially because it's such a good read. Eat Fat, Be Healthy by Matthew Bayan. His Bayan. His website again is the W's and eatfatbehealthy.com. Thank you very much for writing the book, and I do hope you write another book about your experiences, because it's a good reading.
Thank you for your kind words. That's the nicest review I've gotten so far, and I really appreciate it.
And also, please try to stay alive, if you could, please.
Well, if you could see me right now, you'd see that I look very healthy.
I'm very happy to hear that.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks again.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thanks to Lisa Ballard for running the board. Reminder, if you want to get a cassette copy of today's show, no transcripts are available, I'm sorry. You can call my information number. You can also get information about me there. It's 707-773-4727. 707-773-4727. You can get a list of tapes that are available if you want this tape or another tape by going to the website. And the easiest way to do that is to go to the KPFA website at www.kpfa.org and follow the links to your own health and fitness. Next week, a repeat of a show with Eva Edelman discussing her book Natural Healing for Schizophrenia and Other Common Mental Disorders. This is an orthomolecular approach to psychiatric symptoms. Quite an engaging book, and I wanted you to hear the show again while we're talking about orthomolecular medicine. I'm Lena Berman. You've been listening to Your Own Health and Fitness, which is produced live in the studios of listener-sponsored Free Speech Radio. May it live forever. KPFA-FM, Berkeley, California.